At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thanks as always for subscribing, downloading and rating and letting people know about the show generally. We really do appreciate it. If you'd like to contact us here on the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're @NewstalkScience. Coming up on this week's program, we'll be asking, what exactly are vitamins and do we really need them anyway? The supplement business is a multi-billion euro industry. But what good is it doing us? We'll be finding out after the news round, where we look back at the week's science news. Joining us now via Skype is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland, and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. Our first story has to do with a trip to Venus, Shane.
No, it has to do with two trips to Venus, Jonathan. Right. Yes, we are going back to Venus, and by we, I mean NASA, but like, NASA are really good at the PR, so we're all allowed to get on board with American trips into space. And they're sending two missions to the planet Venus before the year 2030 that will come in at a whopping $1 billion. Just imagining what Science Foundation Ireland could do with $1 billion worth of investment. But the Americans are putting it into two trips to Venus. This will be our first time back to Venus since 1989. And they're saying it'll allow us to rediscover the planet. And we know so little about it because it's covered in cloud. And so we can't see much into that cloud. We really do know very little. So this first mission, it's called Da Vinci. And that's an acronym for Deep Atmosphere Venus Investigation of Noble Gases, Chemistry and Imaging. So good luck to the postdoc who actually came up with that. Catchy is right. And they're going to look at the composition of Venus's atmosphere. And from that, they'll be able to tell how the planet was formed, how it evolved, and crucially, if there was ever an ocean on it. So they reckon that because Venus is in the so-called Goldilocks zone, as in it's close enough to the sun, but yet not too close for liquid water to exist on its surface, they reckon there may have been oceans on the planet in the past. And so life could have taken there at a previous point. It may be there now.
Are they going to stick their hands out the window? Are they going to grab samples of the atmosphere of Venus, or is it just sort of onboard sensors?
Well, I suppose the scientists would say, what's the difference, right? So it's just as to what they're collecting and how they'll measure it, it's a very fine line. So they'll do things like spectroscopy, which is looking at the composition of these gases. The second mission is called Veritas, and that's Venus Emissivity Radio Science Topography and Spectroscopy. And the aim with this one here is to map the surface of Venus and to determine the planet's geological history and understand how it evolved so differently to Earth. And they'll actually be able to make 3D reconstructions of what they observe. So we'll get this topography of the surface. The NASA chief.
We haven't got that yet, have we? We haven't got anything close to it. We just have sort of pictures and then sort of measurements of the atmosphere by firing light through it, right?
Yeah, that's about it. And remember last year we did a story on detecting a particular gas in the atmosphere of Venus, and we wondered maybe there was a signal of something organic there. We detected a gas called phosphine. So the NASA chief is very excited, saying this is the decade for Venus. Enough about Mars.
Very good. Ruth, our second story has to do with quite a big look into a very simple intervention for depression.
Yes, this is a story all about sleep. And we've been talking a lot about sleep of late because we've been talking about daylight saving time. So, you know, we've been talking about that shift in the hour and people losing an hour of sleep in the springtime. And we know from looking at big studies, about a quarter of the world do this daylight saving. And we know that rates of certain diseases go up when people lose that important hour of sleep. We know there's a higher incidence of heart attacks straight after daylight saving.
Wow.
There's higher incidence of fatal traffic accidents and other things. But what and we know that sleep is highly connected to having a healthy immune system, a healthy body, all of those things. But this study is really trying to hone in on, well, how much sleep do you need for good mental health and to prevent things like anxiety and depression? So researchers at the University of Colorado at Boulder and the Broad Institute, which of course is famous for doing big, big genetic studies based at Harvard and MIT, they looked at 840,000 people that they had biobank material for. Actually collaborating with the company 23andMe, you know, where people send a lot of their information, and a lot of people who send information allow it to be used anonymously in studies like this. And what they did was, with that biobank data, they looked at 340 different parts of the genome where we know there's genes or parts of the genome that are influenced your chronotype. And what your chronotype is when your body likes to sleep. So we've all heard the idea of larks and owls. You know, some people are great at getting up in the morning. Some people like to stay up late at night. And actually, what was really interesting about this data was nearly 100,000 of the people actually wore sleep trackers. So we actually had really good data. Wow. For when they actually went to sleep, as opposed to people just trying to remember when they normally go to sleep. And what they found was, very conclusively, those people that had the genetic variants that predispose them to get up early, and they do tend to get up earlier, had a much lower risk of having a major depressive disorder. In fact, just getting up that hour earlier reduced that risk by 23%. And if it was, wow, 2 hours earlier, it was 40%.
Well,
now I should stress,
then, yeah, if you get up at 1 a.m. in the morning, you'll never get depressed.
Well, what they look at is the midpoint of your sleep. And obviously the amount of sleep matters as well. I was actually interested, the average here in these, you know, hundreds of thousands of people was actually going to sleep at 11 and getting up at 6, which I didn't feel so bad about, because actually that's kind of where I, when I go to sleep, and I always think that's too late to go to bed and too early to get up.
I'm sorry, you think 11 is too late to go to bed?
Yeah, but I think
I agree.
Maybe, do you agree?
I go to bed.
We must be lost.
Yeah, I'm asleep at 11 o'clock every night and awake around 6.
That is party time in our house, 11 o'clock. 11
o'clock. Don't you have two children?
I do. That's why it's party time, because they're asleep. Yeah. So they're saying 11 a.m. to 6. And if you get up an hour earlier than that at 5.
No. So I should say, so the midpoint of your sleep goes back by an hour. So it's the same amount of sleep, but just the mid, they use the midpoint to measure. So obviously, you know, it's that midpoint that counts. And other studies have shown as well that those hours before midnight are really important as well for sleep. But
I didn't know
I should
that.
Stress, again, there is no cause and effect here. It's a very big study and there's a huge amount of evidence. But you know, a lot of people, particularly those who are night owls, would say the world is designed for morning people. And that actually can be very stressful. And so that doesn't necessarily help your mental state. And the other thing is, we do know that daylight is very important. So, you know, it may just be that if you're getting up later, you're getting less daylight. So that may contribute to depression. But it's a really interesting study, and it was great to get that specific information. And I think, in fact, as that use of, you know, fitness trackers and wearables all increases, we're going to be able to untangle some of these lifestyle things much more than we've been able to in the past.
Really interesting. Love to hear from you at home. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us. We're at Newstalk Science. You can text us for 30 cent, 53106. Like, are you, like Ruth, going to bed at 11 o'clock, getting up at 6? I would imagine there are not many like you, Ruth. I'd imagine most people are getting to bed a bit later and getting up a bit later. Anyway, love to hear from you. You can let us know how you sleep. Our third story, Shane, has to do with a very deep pool.
Yeah, it's all about the pools in England this week. So in Cornwall, they are going to build the world's deepest pool. And they say it's going to be used to train astronauts. How cool is that? So it's 50 meters by 40, right? So standard enough pool. And in the middle of it, then it'll have a cylindrical shaft that will extend down 50 meters, which is incredibly deep. It's been built by a company that's straight out of a James Bond film called The Blue Abyss, and it's going to cost £150 million. And, you know, this is the one time when giving equivalent volumes in Olympic-sized swimming pools is actually appropriate. So it's going to be 17 Olympic-sized swimming pools in volume, which is huge. And they'll have a massive crane next to it to lower objects down into it. So they say there's three reasons they want to do it. Training for astronauts, so they'll be able to simulate low gravity in there, because they'll reach a point called neutral buoyancy, where the force down from gravity is met by the upthrust from the water within, the buoyancy forces. And so they'll neither sink nor rise to the top. Instead, they'll just kind of be able to move around in the water like a diver can do very efficiently, which is the most bamboozling physics ever.
Wait. You're saying in just 50 meters, you can reach that neutrality?
You can reach it in 2 meters. So it's if you ask a scuba diver, right, if you get into as a scuba diver, you'll sink, right, unless you calibrate the gases correctly such that you've enough upward force to counteract the heaviness of you and the suit, right? Beyond that, being able to move vertically in the water is about your propulsion. So you're going to swim through the water. You're completely effectively weightless at that point, as if you would be in space. It's incredible.
I've misunderstood this, because I've done the paddy training. I understand that. Why do you need 50 meters? I thought I was thinking of something completely different. Why do we need 50 meter pool then?
And I've been thinking about this all day until I realized you need 50 meters in that dimension. So you have three dimensions in which to move. If you only had 2 meters of depth, you wouldn't be able to simulate many things, right? Because you'd only be able to move 2 meters in one direction. If you 50, then you can move 50 meters in one direction, and you can move 40 meters in another, and a further 50 meters in a third direction. So you have a huge volume in which you can move and thus simulate being outside of the International Space Station or something like that.
Nah, I'm fully convinced that's worth £150 million, to be honest.
No, well, they also say it could be used to test remotely operated vehicles. That's hugely associated with offshore wind. That's important. Okay. And film sets. Yes, there's actually a market for underwater filming. And they're all about pools in the UK, as we know. In London, they have built that swimming pool that's suspended between two towers. It's 10 stories above the ground. It's made entirely from plastic, something called acrylic. And the base of it is a foot or 30 centimetres thick. Would you get in it? Absolutely not for me.
I was going to say, did they add "because we can" to the list of the reasons for building either of those two pools, Shane?
I imagine there's an awful lot of that going on in both of those projects, Ruth.
I think anything that has the "est" at the end of it in British science at the moment is getting greenlit. The biggest, the smallest, the widest, the
silliest.
Our final story, Ruth, has to do with being able to hear supersonic sound.
I know. I mean, one of the things that we all, you know, think about with science is, can we use science to enhance our bodies, to give us extra powers? And I suppose we're starting to see the beginning of that, even with just things like Google Translate, to be able to walk around and maybe use an app on the phone to understand lots of different languages and be able to talk back in many languages. But this is about hearing. And most humans, we can hear sound waves between about 20 and 20,000 hertz. And again, we might have talked about it before in the show, that's, you know, young children can hear higher sounds, and you lose a bit of that bandwidth as you get a bit older. But lots of other animals communicate in sound that is of higher frequency, and that's called ultrasonic sound. And it's exactly the same technique that's used for an ultrasound, for example, if you're having a medical ultrasound. So very high frequency sound waves are, you know, transmitted into the body, and then they essentially bounce back. And the different kinds of echoes that come back as the sound moves through bone or tissue gives a picture of what's going on inside the body. And animals use it the same way. So bats very famously use it. They use it to echolocate, where they emit these high frequency sound waves that bounce off caves and help them build a map. Now, we can't hear those, obviously, until now. So researchers from Finland have built this kind of simple but very clever contraption, which if you can imagine it, it looks like a regular headset that a lot of us are spending time in now on Zoom. But at the top of the head, there's a long bar that sticks out towards the front of your head with a little sphere. And on that sphere, they've mounted a whole load of special microphones that can pick up ultrasonic sound. Those kind of microphones have been around for ages, but by mounting them on this sphere, what they're actually able to do is infer the direction that the ultrasonic sound is coming from. Now, then they're using a very clever kind of frequency shifting and playing that sound back into the headphones. So they're bringing it down to an audible pitch, but also giving the listener the direction that the sound is coming from. So when they're in a cave with bats, they can actually hear a bat coming towards them and the direction that it's coming from. So yeah, it's kind of a simple idea, but sort of cool. And actually, as humans, when we hear a faint sound, we tend to turn our heads to try and get an exact alignment so we can hear those sound waves better. And of course, this little sphere turns with us, so turns with someone who's wearing it. So it gives a really, really close approximation to how we hear normally, but allowing us to hear those amazing ultrasonic sounds.
I hate asking this question, but are there any practical applications for it? Like, is it going to make anyone any money?
Well, interestingly enough, actually, when things go wrong in some of our equipment, often ultrasonic sounds are emitted and we can't hear them. So things like leaking gas pipes and damaged electronics emit these sounds. And often we use sort of quite crude ways to maybe go along a gas pipe and hear a sound. But actually being able to hear it directionally and in an easy wearable device could be quite handy for people. But also, I think just actually being able to listen in to a world of sound that we don't have access to. I mean, there is one primate that actually communicates in ultrasonic sound, the tarsier, a little primate, but we can't hear it. So in a way, it's an amazing, it's like a telescope looking up into space, allowing us to see further. This is allowing us to hear further.
I think if you tickle a rat, it will laugh, but in ultrasound. I think you'll find that's actually true. I think you'll find that's true.
I wouldn't doubt you, Jonathan.
Well, okay, the sarcasm is dripping off that comment. But no, I suppose, I mean, the directional part of this is what's really exciting, because you can sort of look around. Previously, you just hear noise, but you wouldn't know where it was coming from to look around. Yeah, it's kind of, it could be a good little thing you strap on people's heads if they're going for tours around bat caves.
Yeah, or maybe see the thing about it is, not so much now, I guess, but I think, there's a world of sound out there that we just don't know about. And I think if you have an easy to wear, much more natural way of hearing it, you're much more likely to go out and look for it.
So it's probably lots of screeching, though. We probably go, oh wow, I can hear an ultrasound. It's like, eh, which actually you don't want to hear. Well, thus ends another bizarre version of our news round here on Future Proof. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland, Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks very much. Now, we all know about the basic food groups and exercise and health and vitality. Wellness has become such a huge industry. But getting in at the early ages was the producers of vitamin supplements. This has been around for a very long time and always tied to wellness and being healthy. But what are vitamins and what exactly do we need to maintain a healthy lifestyle? That and a lot more is explored in a book by Catherine Price. She's a science writer and author of Vitamania. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
What is the beginning of this story? Because obviously there was a point at which nobody knew about vitamins and also nobody needed them in their day-to-day routine.
Well, I always like to start by clarifying the difference between a vitamin and a dietary supplement. So right now we use those terms very interchangeably, but they're actually not the same thing. Vitamins are specific compounds found in foods, normally in foods, that we need in very tiny amounts in order to have our bodies function properly. And without these vitamins, our bodies can't carry on the processes that are necessary to keep us alive. So vitamins are absolutely essential for life, but not vitamins in pill form. Also worth noting, there's only 13 human vitamins, whereas the last time I checked in the United States, there were something like 85,000 dietary supplements on the market. So there's 13 human vitamins, but if you have dietary supplements, that's kind of a catch-all category that includes not just vitamins, but also all the minerals and then all the amino acid supplements and the protein powders and the stuff. Sexual enhancement things, like everything. And we can get into this later if you'd like, but it was a very deliberate part in the deliberate move on the part of the American supplement industry to get consumers to use those two terms interchangeably. So I'm clarifying that just to say that we have always needed vitamins. Human beings need vitamins normally from foods. Sometimes we can make them on our own, such as vitamin D. We do not need dietary supplements in most cases. With that said, there are situations, medical conditions or dietary restrictions that do require supplementation with vitamins.
All right, I'm going to explore that with you in a bit. But when did our understanding of vitamins arise? When did we realize that vitamins were a thing?
Our understanding of vitamins, by the way, vitamins, I'm American, I can't help myself.
No, you say vitamins, I'll say vitamins, everyone can figure it out.
Exactly, yeah. And let's call the whole thing off. So vitamins were not discovered in one aha moment. It wasn't like someone was like, oh, there's an X on the map and underneath that is the cure to scurvy. Vitamins, our understanding of vitamins developed over a long period of time. For example, the ancient Egyptians knew that feeding liver to people somehow cured this condition called night blindness, but they did not know that's because the liver contained vitamin A and that's necessary for sight. So it really was a long process, but in terms of isolating these compounds, that really happened at the turn of the 20th century, which is kind of crazy to think that it's really only been about 120 years since these things were fully conceptualized. And it took a long time for many reasons. I mean, obviously scientific tools were not what they are today, but also when germ theory became popularized and became a thing in the late 19th century, that really got everybody looking for microbial causes of diseases. And so people were looking for bacteria or some kind of microorganism that caused disease. They were not looking for something that wasn't there, which is a really difficult thing to even begin to conceptualize. So our modern understanding of the compounds that we call vitamins now really was turn of the 20th century. And then in terms of the rise of the modern supplement industry, that started to happen in like the 20s and 30s in the United States when it became possible to start to synthesize some of these compounds. But people really started to take the vitamins and the industry exploded in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s until it got to where it is today.
So these vitamins are essentially just complex molecules. Is that what separates them from, I don't know, things like fats or oils, or what specifically defines a vitamin?
That seems like it should be an interesting question to answer, the question of how do you define a vitamin? But it's actually more complicated because of the way they were discovered. They're lumped together really out of historical happenstance rather than any defined shared characteristic in their chemistry. Broadly speaking, you can think about food as being macronutrients and micronutrients plus salt and water. So the macronutrients are fat, carbohydrate, and protein, all of which we need. Actually, we don't technically need carbohydrates, but we need those to fuel our bodies and to build our bodies. But then you also need vitamins and minerals to cause the reactions that help keep us alive. So to allow our cells to process energy and to breathe, for example. So vitamins originally were thought of, their name was vital amines. The term was coined by this guy, Casimir Funk, who is a Polish biochemist who really should get some kind of award for marketing because he came up with this term. The other ideas people had at the time were things like accessory food factors or food hormones, things that really you would not have like a multi-billion dollar industry on accessory food factors. Vitamins combines the Latin word for life with amine, which was the chemical structure that he thought they all would share, but they don't actually. And actually in the 1920s, it was suggested that the term be dropped completely, but it wasn't. So instead what they did is they chopped off the end E. It used to be vitamine with an E at the end. So it became vitamin. And then they combined the letters because some other people, so all these biochemists were competing with each other to discover these compounds and to give them their own names. So the other terminology that was commonplace at that time was A, you know, B, like the categorizing them by letter. So the two categories kind of got lumped together and that's how we ended up with vitamin A, vitamin B, vitamin C, and there's multiple B vitamins. And then it skips some letters because some of those compounds were later discovered to not be vitamins or to be duplicates, or there was some reason that it's like A, B, C, D, like K.
All right. But even when we discovered vitamins, it took a while for people to sort of realize their importance, right?
It took a while for people to recognize that you could have a disease that was caused by something that was not there. And then it took a really long time to figure out what that thing possibly could be, because you're looking for a substance that's invisible and tasteless and you need in like microscopic amounts, like truly tiny amounts. you know, fractions of a grain of salt in some cases for your daily requirements. So it really took a long time for people to even conceptualize of what a vitamin could be. And then it was a matter of investigating diets, often in the form of this thing called purified diets. Like you'd feed mice these diets that were supposedly perfect and supposedly could allow these animals to thrive, and then they'd keep dying. And that was actually one of the hints that researchers got, that there was something that was missing. It's like, why do these mice or these rats or these guinea pigs or whatever it was keep having these issues and dying? And then it's like, oh, did they have an infection? You know, what was causing this problem? And eventually people came to hypothesize and then prove that actually the problem was not what was there, but what was missing from their diets.
Tell me about this guy, Joseph Goldberger.
So Joseph Goldberger was a researcher in the United States who was working on a disease called pellagra, which we now know is a niacin deficiency, but that was not known at the time. And pellagra was a horrible disease that killed hundreds of thousands of people and was afflicting, like, I'm not going to get my dates exactly right, but it was hundreds of thousands of people a year were suffering from pellagra, particularly in the American South. And it was due to their diet, but that was not known at the time. And Joseph Goldberger was convinced that there was a dietary cause. But even though vitamins by that point had been discovered and were acknowledged and were a thing, it's not controversial that vitamins existed, people still insisted that it must be caused by a microbe. And so at some point, Joseph Goldberger, in the spirit of the scientists of his day, who did a lot of self-experimentation, injected himself with the blood of patients who had pellagra to show, or hopefully show, that it wasn't caused by a microbe. And sure enough, he didn't get sick. People still didn't believe him after that, but it took a very long time to convince everyone that this was caused by the lack of something. And it turned out that there's a basic photography chemical that was discovered in the 1860s or 70s, which is one of the forms of niacin that then became a synthetic form of niacin that actually is the solution to this horrible disease. But it was hailed as a miracle by the New York Times when niacin was actually recognized as the deficiency that was causing pellagra.
I mean, he went even further than that, though, didn't he, when it came to sort of trying to convince people of this, having sort of filth parties.
Yes, where he would kind of get various substances from people with pellagra's bodies and then put them on or inject them into healthy volunteers. And I mean, I don't know how he convinced people to attend these parties, or if it was like his medical students or something who were forced to. But yeah, it was like, oh, let's take some secretions from the nose of someone with pellagra and let's smear it in your nose. It was just, I wouldn't go to the party. But eventually people did, you know, he was mocked, totally mocked. And he was also Jewish and that didn't help. He was in the American South in the 30s. And anyway, but eventually it was recognized that that was indeed a dietary deficiency disease.
Yeah, the bit that really got me was that he was filling these pills with urine and feces and dried skin flakes taken from
the dried skin flakes.
I mean, that's really like, that's
above and beyond. It's almost like the feces in the urine are like not. Yeah,
you don't need to go that far. We get it.
But it was a disease. It is a disease that causes the horrible rashes and scaly rashes. And so there's a reason they would think that the microbe might be present in the dried skin flakes, and there were many of them. But yeah, again, not going to that party.
So the purpose of these vitamins was eventually recognized as being really important for things like sight, skin, things like scurvy and so on, these other diseases. Is a complete lack of any of these vitamins always going to end in a disease?
I'm trying to think of all the, I mean, so this is one of those things where I'm like, I'm gonna have to go through every single one of them, but yes, typically, a lack of any of the vitamins is going to result in a disease. So right. For vitamin C, you've got scurvy. For vitamin D, you've got rickets. For niacin, you've got pellagra. For thiamine, B1, you've got beriberi, which we don't even know about anymore because that's not a thing. But right. Yes, they're but basically, the idea is that vitamins are helping with these reactions that keep us alive or that keep our bodies functioning in some way. You take away this little helper, the vitamin, and our bodies can't complete the processes they need to achieve that function. And it manifests, these deficiencies manifest in many different ways. Like rickets, you're gonna have soft bones and soft teeth, and scurvy with vitamin C, you're not gonna be able to make collagen, which is a protein that essentially keeps, it's from the word for glue. So it keeps our body's tissues together. You can imagine if they didn't have glue to keep them together, there's some really disgusting and fatal results. But it's very interesting to me to think that because these are nutritional deficiency diseases, you can never eradicate them because the only prevention is a good diet. So yeah, if you start to extrapolate this, it's just interesting to think about what we've done to modern food through processing, which we can talk about more, that has removed many of these vitamins. And now we have to add them back in an artificial form. And there's not to say there's anything wrong with the artificial form of the vitamins per se, but if you then start to think bigger about where are you getting the artificial vitamins from, you start to realize that some countries like the United States are extremely dependent on other countries such as India and China for our basic nutritional needs. And if that were cut off, we'd kind of be screwed.
So this vitamins business is obviously a multi-billion euro global economy in and of itself.
Dietary supplements, yeah.
Yeah. So what is the benefits of taking these vitamins? If we take them, does our body ingest them in the same way, or can it take the value out of them? Because obviously some vitamins, like for example, vitamin C, once you reach your threshold for the day, the rest of it is useless to you. Are there cases where taking a vitamin pill doesn't actually give you that because it's destroyed in the stomach, or it doesn't get delivered to where it needs to? I mean, those vitamin supplements, do they do what they're supposed to do?
Well, that's a whole separate subject of conversation of whether the vitamin supplements and the dietary supplements do what they say they do or contain what they say that they do. So let's assume that the pills you're taking actually do contain, we'll talk about vitamins in particular, the vitamin in the amount it says on the label in a form that is bioactive and available to your body. Then the synthetic ones are not going to be hugely different from the ones you'll find in food. But what I like to say to people when they ask me, like, should I be taking vitamin supplements? Well, basically I say, I have no idea if you should be taking a vitamin supplement because I don't know anything about your health conditions or your diet. So if you are someone who doesn't have a special diet, for example, being a vegan or some kind of medical condition that interferes with absorption, or if you're not above 50 or 60, because you start to lose the ability to make some of the chemicals in your body necessary to absorb the vitamins as you get older. So if you're like a young, healthy person with no dietary restrictions, then you probably are fine getting your vitamins just from food. Then the question becomes, what kind of food? Well, and this is where I think it's very interesting too, is that there's like three categories of people as I think about it. You've got the people who are eating as if they're living off the cover of a Michael Pollan book, the guy who wrote In Defense of Food and The Omnivore's Dilemma, is a famous food journalist here, is very into whole natural foods and plant-based diets. And although you do need, I mean, there's a lot of really good stuff in meat and dairy too. So in that case, you don't need to take a vitamin supplement because you're getting it from your food, possible exception of vitamin D, which we can talk about, but you're also getting all these other compounds in food that we do not fully understand and that may work synergistically together. There's just all sorts of stuff in food. Like, food is medicine. It's doing stuff in our body. So eating like that, you probably don't need to take a supplement. Then you've got the broad category of people who are eating a lot of processed foods, but those processed foods may actually have vitamins added to them or sprayed on them. Say you eat a lot of breakfast cereal. For example, there's a breakfast cereal in the States called Total that has all these vitamins and minerals added to, which is like literally in many cases sprayed onto it in this giant drum, which is a separate interesting factoid. But anyway, in that case, you're probably fine with vitamins and minerals, but you're missing out on all the other things that were in the whole food before it was processed and before the vitamins were added back in. Then you've got some people who are eating such poor diets. They're eating processed food that hasn't even had stuff added back in. You know, there was a small outbreak of scurvy at some point in Massachusetts here. The people in an institution who were not getting a diet that had these vitamins added back in. There was one guy who was just existing on like ice cream and American cheese, and that is really not going to serve you very well. So yes, but then if you do have some kind of medical condition, or for example, if you're a woman of childbearing age who's thinking of getting pregnant, like there are situations in which you do want to kind of make sure that you are topping off your vitamin needs. But I also like to point out that we act as if vitamins are only good for us. And this is the genius of the name vitamin, right? With the vita in it. It's like it only can do good things. But what in life can only do good things? Water can kill you. Oxygen can kill you. Like, it's all in the right amount. And in the case of vitamins, you have water-soluble vitamins like vitamin C, and you've got fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin A. The fat-soluble vitamins are going to stick around in your body for a lot longer because they're absorbed into the fat. Those are particularly able to be toxic. So vitamin A can be toxic in large doses for sure. Vitamin D is actually used as a rat poison, which is interesting because there's doses that are toxic to rats that are not toxic to, for example, small children. Anyway, but even with things like vitamin C, I just question whether it's really a great idea to be saturating our body's tissues with huge amounts of vitamin C. And the analogy I like to use is if you've got a plant that obviously needs water, you're going to give it water. But if you just constantly douse that plant with water and saturate the soil, eventually, sure, it's going to run out the bottom of the pot, you hope. And that's when people say, like Americans in particular have very expensive urine because of our dietary supplement habits. But you can also have a situation where the water doesn't all get out and the roots rot and you're causing problems by adding so much water. So I really strongly recommend people not think about vitamins as something that can only do good and never do harm. I don't think it's a good idea to just take mega doses of these things and just assume that you're going to be okay.
And what is it like in America when it comes to vitamin use? Because I don't think any of my friends, I'm mid-40s, I don't think any of them regularly take any vitamins or dietary supplements. We just, it's not really a huge thing for a lot of people. I mean, obviously some people who buy into it, but I don't, is every American sort of seeing it like brushing your teeth? I mean, what sort of numbers are we looking at?
It's so interesting culturally. Yes, Americans are seeing it like brushing your teeth. I'm actually surprised there's not like a vitamin-infused toothpaste. We have these stores, these chains. One's called the Vitamin Shop, shop with two P's and an E at the end to make it seem quaint. That sells just dietary supplements. There's GNC, which, I mean, just entire stores. There's mail order companies that sell direct-to-consumer vitamins, all sorts. Like, yes, and I would say when I give talks in the States about vitamins, I mean, I've had a one woman at a talk came up to me and she literally had a bag that she shook and it just, you could hear all the pills rattling. And she was like, I think I'm going to return these. I just spent $200 in Whole Foods on these pills. It's very common in the United States. I would say even among my friends who are relatively like scientifically educated, there's still, like, I just saw a friend this weekend who has a baby and she's trying to boost milk production and she's taking fenugreek supplements. And yeah, it's
yeah,
a thing.
Well, pregnant moms and newborn moms are huge targets for these, both healthcare, you know, it's just a vulnerable time in your life and there's lots of companies getting in on that.
Folic acid is important when you're pregnant. I mean, it prevents birth defects that form in the first couple of weeks, like even before you know you're pregnant. It prevents what are called neural tube defects, which is the part of the embryo that becomes the spinal cord. So, you know, in the States, enriched flour has been fortified with folic acid since, I believe, 1997 or so. But then it's interesting because that actually has helped to lower the rate of neural tube defects. But then you get to the question of you're supplementing the entire population and most people are not pregnant women. So what's the long-term effect? Because when you start to add up the amount of these vitamins and compounds that you find in different products, say you have the breakfast cereal, but then you also have a sports drink, then you also have a sports bar, and then you also have a sandwich made with enriched flour bread. And you can really start to get to quite high levels of these things quickly without realizing it at all.
Mm. It is. I mean, it's very interesting. Culturally, I wonder about the rest of Europe, and perhaps listeners listening in would say, everyone I know takes vitamins, but it just doesn't seem to be in my social circle.
I've heard, you know, I remember hearing a story about someone from Italy, like people who actually, when they come to the States, like bring suitcases to fill up with vitamins and supplements because it's so easy to get them here. Like there's nearly no, they're very, very, very lightly regulated. And there are these stores that are just, I mean, even American military bases have these GNC stores and these vitamin shops on the base, like for the, I think they call them war fighters now, but anyway, for the soldiers and whatever to buy.
You call soldiers war fighters?
I think it's a catch-all term for members of the military, but this was in 2013, so they may have changed it, but yes. Okay. Sorry, that's a separate conversation.
Yeah,
anyway.
But what I was going to ask you is, how in looking at your book, how scientific did you find the literature and marketing for these supplements and vitamins when you were doing your research? And has it changed since?
The scientific evidence behind dietary supplements varies widely. And it is a huge problem for many reasons. One is that as consumers, you cannot trust that there's been any research backing the claims on the product's label. But you also have some products or compounds that genuinely could have medicinal pharmaceutical purposes that are not regulated like drugs, and therefore are kind of looked at with skepticism and not studied in a way that would identify a proper dose for a particular condition. It's actually truly crazy, because people to sort of back up again, there's this halo of health that comes from the term vitamin, right? Vita, it's health. They're only good for you. That's what people think. And they also think they're natural, quote unquote, because they, you know, usually come from food. But that's not true, that they can only be good for you. And then you start to expand this to this broader category of dietary supplements, and you start to assume this, to assign the same properties to this much broader category of dietary supplements as you do to the actual vitamins. I mean, there are products in the States with names like Black Widow Extreme, and people, they're regulated exactly the same as a vitamin C supplement, which is crazy. But what people seem to not really absorb or comprehend is that vitamins do things, vitamins, the 13 vitamins, they do things in your body. They are biologically active compounds. They are essentially the same as taking Tylenol in the sense that it's doing something. It's not just, I don't know, some magic pill that only does something good and is not actually affecting the cells in your body.
Yeah.
I would argue that therefore they should be regulated like over-the-counter drugs. But, you know, they do something, so we should be careful about them.
Mm. And in Europe, I think it's a different story. We are much more closely regulated when it comes to food and drugs, it seems.
Well, we've got good food and drug regulations. There's particularly drugs, like pharmaceutical drugs. But just as an example, like if you go into a store in the United States, like a drugstore, and you buy toothpaste, the back of the box will say drug facts. If you go into the store and you buy vitamin C, it's going to have supplement facts. And those are entirely different categories, and which is to say the toothpaste is regulated more stringently than whatever pill you're ingesting, which makes total sense that you would want to regulate toothpaste if you think about it, because you're putting a substance in your mouth and you don't want it to like peel off the inside of your tongue or something. But it's just astonishing in the States to realize that you've got these like mouthwash being regulated as an over-the-counter drug, and then Black Widow Extreme is not. I mean, who's taking that? That's my other question. Who thinks it's a good idea?
What is the future of this industry look like? Does it get better and more scientific and more personalized, or what have you seen?
The future of the industry, I think, again, depends on which manufacturer you're talking about, right? Like, there's no reason for many dietary supplement makers to change what they're doing, because they're enormously profitable already. What would change is the marketing gimmicks they use. And as is often true with marketing gimmicks, like some of those actually based on real science and some of them are going to be totally not. But the allure will be the same. So personalized nutrition, if I tell you I have a personalized regimen of supplements just for you, which is a thing in the States, like you can get this quote personalized, they call it a vitamin pack, but it's dietary supplements. That's very appealing to people because it's personalized. We love personalization. If you ask me about the actual science of where this stuff is going, like what's the future of nutrition? First, I would say, I think there's a real cautionary tale to be learned from the story of vitamins that I came up on again and again in my research, which is that we don't understand the intricacies of food and how it works in our bodies. And that was the problem for these early nutritional researchers I was telling you about, who ended up killing these lab animals with their supposed purified diets that were supposed to be perfect because there was something missing. And right now, I think we're still under this assumption that we understand what the body needs and what amounts, when we really don't. But I think that the frontier of nutritional science is, the two main things that come to my mind is the microbiome. So how all the microorganisms that live in our gut and elsewhere in our body, how they interact with food and how they help reactions and what they do for health and for things like your risk of type 2 diabetes or obesity or even cancer. Like, that is fascinating. And then also epigenetics, which is basically like how our environment affects how our genes are expressed. So, you know, you're born with particular genes that, for example, I've got type 1 diabetes. I was born with genes that predisposed me to that condition, but it wasn't until I was 22 and something in my environment triggered those genes to express themselves that I actually developed the disease. So the something in the environment is known as epigenetics. And that is a truly fascinating realm of research that is very strongly affected by nutrition. Not just in terms of the actual food you eat, but maybe the chemicals that are on the food, and actually can be passed down through generations, which is also truly nuts. So like what my grandmother ate could actually affect me. So those are two broad areas I think that are fascinating to follow.
There is so much in this. If you want to know more about our relationship with vitamins, the book is called Vitamania. It's written by Catherine Price. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, yeah, do you know what we should do? We should have a competition and we should try and find the listener who pops the most unprescribed pills and let us know what that is.
So, no,
it's a good idea. No. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins me to go through the texts and tweets from last week. This is a brilliant idea. I said, listen, non-prescribed. and you're not allowed, do it from now on. It has to be like yesterday. So if you're listening to this now, it has to be yesterday. Tell me how many unprescribed pills you took that are like, they're not drugs or medication. They're just like food supplements like vitamin C or cod liver oil or whatever, that sort of stuff. I want to see
taking. We're not making people do this.
No. It's retrospective. I'm not an idiot. It's retrospective. I've only killed 3 people on this program and I'm not going to make it a handful. So
fair enough.
What I like broadcasters have this power over people that they listen to and they go, I'm going to, like, it's such, you know, when we say, oh, you know, don't do this at home, it really does belittle the intelligence of our listeners when we do that, when we say that sort of caveat stuff, I find. Although people did inject themselves with bleach, didn't they? Like, they're,
yeah,
oh,
but I mean
that was America. I know
Donald Trump said that.
I didn't know. We didn't say that. Donald Trump, yeah. I know, but if I said it,
he's got more sway.
If I said it, I wouldn't be like, oh, I better put in an old caveat. I'm only joking because someone might actually inject themselves with bleach and we'd have a court case in our hands. It turns out that actually does happen with some people. So I guess that's why we have to say the really, you know, caution contents are hot. Right. So don't take a whole load of pills because we're asking how many pills have you taken. But we want to know yesterday, how many pills and supplements did you take in one day? Let us know. We'll see if we have a winner. The prize is,
how many did you take?
A year is none. I don't take any. Here's a confession. I don't wash my face. I don't wash my face because there's no need to wash your face. There's like, you know, I wash it. I shower in the morning, but I don't like wash my face all the time. I wash my hands regularly. And that's pretty much all the maintenance. I shower and I wash my hands regularly. That's all I do. People have these self-care regimens.
Do you wash your face in the shower?
Yeah. I mean, I don't scrub at it or anything. Like, I just don't need a lot of self-maintenance. Maybe I'm lucky. Maybe I don't have the same sort of goo that people like you have. And, you know, that you just constantly need to scrub away the scales. For me, I'm just blessed with fantastic complexion.
Yeah, no, that's grand. Because I'm actually, maybe we're a worryingly small sample size, but I'm the same. I would wash it, but I wash it in the shower.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. I don't go washing it in the sink and the rest of the day. Like,
do you do any of the supplement stuff? Like, are you worried about your vitamin K levels or?
Absolutely not. I kind of think the supplement stuff.
We'll be dead by 45. I'm telling you that now. We'll be like, we don't need the supplements. I'm afraid you've got rickets scurvy. What is that?
No, I would say I have a good diet. I would say that I'm pretty good on that front.
Okay.
And not so good on the exercise at the moment since the pandemic hit, but I'd say my diet's decent.
Yeah.
Probably too much sugar in it, but there's lots of variation and, you know, probably most of my vitamins are sorted pretty well.
Yeah. We as we heard from our interview, we get almost all the vitamins we need by going outside and eating normal food.
Yeah. A lot of it is like you... For people, this is really unfair, but for people who eat shit, they're like, oh, well, if I throw these tablets...
No, I don't think it's them. I don't think it's them.
I can justify my eating of shit.
No, I think it's people who eat healthy see these as more healthy. So, like, they would eat healthy and then it would add. Like, you don't find this stuff next to the burgers. You find it in health food shops, right? And I think it's people who are already really healthy wanting to go that little bit more... just to be really healthier than the Joneses next door. So I'd love to hear from you. If you take a lot of these supplements, we've already prejudged you, so now you're probably less likely to admit it. But it would be interesting to see out of curiosity. So you can anonymize yourself if you want. What about last week, Aidan? We put out this piece I worked for and you worked for months on. And we put it out in the sunniest day of the year. So probably nobody heard it, but it was really good. So if you're listening to the podcast for the first time, check out last week's show. It was good. Did anyone respond to it? Because normally we get like, that was really good. I really enjoyed that. Oh, that radio changed my life when we do these sort of pieces. But this time, not so much.
Yeah, anecdotally, I have a good few people.
Anecdotally, on a science program, you're going to say, oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, I didn't do a full survey of the population.
Anecdotally, injecting bleach is fine.
I didn't account for various demographics. I just literally talked to the people who I talked to. I see. And lots of them seemed to like it.
Yeah, but that's a bias. Like, you know this from psychology. You can't just say, oh, people I spoke to said it was good. They're the wrong people. And you can't even be asking the question. You can't even know who's asking the question. And you have to bury the question, a whole bunch of questions about Moncrief and breakfast as sort of controls so you get genuine answers about our own show.
Yeah, but people, you'd be surprised about the people in my circles, how little they like me, you know? So if they're saying it's good, that's probably okay. Control, you know?
So we got an email from Iona. She says, "Dear Jonathan, just heard your show and found it very interesting. I thought I would let you know that I am a certified super recognizer by the Association of Super Recognizer International." Wait, is this person serious? "I am a full-time resident here in Dublin studying a BA in psychology in the Dublin Business School. You've given me enough information for me to be able to hack your bank account now, Iona. Just in case I could be of some help to you in the future, I'm someone a bit more local. Thanks again for an interesting subject matter. So few people are aware of this ability. Iona, I can tell you something. We would have loved to have spoken to you while we were making the program. You would have been the thing that probably tipped us over into making it award winning. But I did ask on Twitter. Obviously, it didn't reach it. But can you Google this, Aidan? I mean, I can, but I kind of feel like it's something you should do. Is the Association of Super Recognizers International? The international bit makes me think it's like like one of those novelty birthday cards you get when you're 60 years old and it says, you know, congratulations, you're a citizen of Florida. Like, you're not a citizen of Florida by getting that birthday card. This is a reference to a Christopher Walken gag from Saturday Night Live a long time ago. Just in case anyone accuses me of stealing jokes. I've had a lot of coffee. Aidan.
I can tell. Well... it did set off my skepticism alarm because part of the research stroke, just random curiosity about this show, I did do a test, a super recognition test to see what happened. Uh-huh. And I did it with the Greenwich University. And that seems to be kind of there was three university ones. I didn't see an international super recognizers association, but maybe they contact you after you did a test.
But there Aidan, there is. I have done your job for you. Which is lowly Googling, excellent. Which normally I don't do, but here you are. And I have found
the
Association of
Google
Super
button.
Recognizers, which looks like a league of superheroes or something. It's very, the website is very slick for, you know, ordinarily what you would imagine is just be sort of academic work. I don't know. It's very corporate looking. Our mission. The mission is to drive up standards. Drive up standards? Standards of recognizing people? What? This is very strange. Anyway, they do a testing thing as well, so you can test yourself. Well, Iona, thank you very much for that. You've opened up a whole new world to us. Unfortunately, we've covered this subject matter now, so probably unlikely to revisit it, unless you've got a really good story, in which case, email us and we'll read it out next week. Patton Oramore says, "Hi, Jonathan. I think I'm a super..." Oh, they're all at it now. "Hi, Jonathan. I think I'm a super recognizer. Unfortunately, it only seems to work for faces on the TV." Not sure that's the thing, Pat. "I can even recognize faces of even more obscure actors if they're disguised or even viewed obliquely. I'm constantly annoying my wife and son with comments like, 'Oh yeah, that was the maid in Downton Abbey.' Sometimes I can't remember the name of the show or the actor, and then I obsess on IMDb until they ferreted out the name, show, and episode. Absolutely useless and pointless superpower indeed." I don't know, skeptic man.
Yeah.
By the way, does
sounds like Pat's a recognizer.
Yeah, I mean, I will say I do that a bit as well, Pat. I don't know if I'm a super recognizer. By the way, your super recognizer alarm, Maiden, does that make a wooga noise, or is it a ding, or is it a light fizzle, or what?
It's definitely a wooga, and it's a direct recording of that British athlete whose catchphrase was a wooga. It's either Chris Akabusi or John Fashanu. I can't remember.
I have no idea.
So that's my one.
You should Google that. If you can find the time,
stop telling me,
and stick that at the end of the podcast as a sign of a sign off, the awuga from Fashanu.
Okay, consider it done.
Sarah Emerson says, had no idea face blindness was a real thing. Always thought it was a spoof in Arrested Development. Marky Bark. I don't remember it in Arrested Development, even though I watched and adored that series. I can't remember who was face blind. Must revisit it. Ben Schultz says, it's always amazed me at the amount of top minds who are and were face blind. John Conway couldn't recognize his next door professor of a decade. And Danny Hillis literally would be talking to Al Gore and not have a clue. I don't know who either of those people are, but they're top minds, apparently. Thanks, Ben. Dermot O'Donovan says, excellent pod on face blindness. Very interesting. Good job. Thanks very much for that, Deirdre. Dermot. So we got some plaudits, didn't we?
Yeah, they all count, right?
Not enough. I mean, not enough to warrant all the work we put into it. So yeah. I hope we get an award.
Love me more, says Jonathan.
Love me more. Have you anything to add? I think that wraps it all up.
Nope, that's about it.
That's fine. Okay, good. That's it from us for this week. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, Garrett Mulhall, and Steve Daunt. Steve McLean was on sound. We'll be back with more on Tuesday. In the meantime, from John Fashanu, I'm hoping you heard an awooga there. We'll see you next week.